You're listening to Energy Insiders, a weekly update on clean energy and climate policy with Renew Economies editor Giles Parkinson and leading energy analyst David Leach. Energy Insiders is brought to you by Evergen, providing cutting-edge energy management software for battery optimization, virtual power plants and distributed energy resources. And Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy, along with the EV-focused The Driven One Step Off the Grid. And joining me as usual is ITK Principal David Leach. David, I trust you're well.
Yes, I trust I am well. Thanks very much, Giles. I trust our listeners are well and well prepared for the storms that we're expecting, the rain bomb on the eastern seaboard. But meanwhile, we're not in Australia for our interview this week. We're over in the United States talking about how technology is advancing.
Yes, well, certainly advancing better than my internet connection up here. I'm sort of pedaling my bicycle and trying to get the dynamo to run because the internet's not working. So fingers crossed. Look, really interesting interview, David, with David Huang from TS Conductor.
Yes, Jason Huang. Jason Huang from TS Conductor. TS Conductor is a relatively new company on the block that's received endorsement from a number of very senior players in the US utilities industry. And it's tackling something that we rarely talk about in this podcast, and that is the changing technology in transmission, above ground transmission wires. There's a few things we don't discuss enough, like distribution and how the regulatory system. But I think transmission technology—it's a big deal. We talk a lot about wind and solar and batteries, but here's what Jason had to say about his product. Jason Huang from TS Conductor, thanks very much for talking to the Energy Insiders podcast.
David, I appreciate the opportunity to be on your podcast. Thank you for the opportunity.
Now, we're talking about a fairly abstruse concept today. That is the material used in transmission conductors. Maybe we could start with a little bit of the history as to how TS Conductor came to be a company at all. What's the concept and what's the need and what market do you serve?
Thank you for that question. You know, when you look at power grid and why we need power grid and why we need to expand capacity in a significant way in power grid, this has to do with climate change. And this also had to do with some of the emerging things that are happening, including AI, for example, AI in data center. We had the warmest temperature on record last year, and our Earth is losing about 400 billion ton ice every year. We have to do something seriously about climate change. We are all in agreement that we need to move away from fossil burning power plant, and we need to go toward renewable generation. To connect all these renewable generation to the power grid, and also to allow energy transition to take place, where today 2/3 of the energy we consume are in the form of non-electricity energy, and we need to convert that into electrical energy. All of that require an adequate power grid that allows you to move the electron from the generation side of the renewable sources to the consumption center. And our grid is still dependent on mostly century-old conductor technology. And these conductors are developed back in 1908, combining hard aluminum with high-strength steel at the time. And the hard aluminum cannot be operated at high temperature. You cannot go above 93 degrees centigrade. So we have limited capacity. And the aluminum is not the most conductive type, so there's also higher loss as well. That really defines the power grid. Where TS comes in is we have a technology that combines the best material science had to offer today, not what the industry was able to do 100 plus years ago. Namely, we combine the most conductive type of aluminum, that's the annealed aluminum, that is not constrained by temperature, with carbon composite core that is twice the strength of steel, 20% of the weight of steel, and it has no thermal expansion, which means it doesn't sag. This technology also comes with a very effective protection of the carbon core through this aluminum encapsulation protection. And that made our conductor not only compatible with industry traditional work practice for conventional conductors, it also has product safety, reliability, and longevity or design in besides the performance attribute. For example, we can triple the conductor's capacity compared to the conventional lines on the same structure. And at the same time, we are also able to reduce line loss by as much as half. And we can do it cheaper on a project cost basis compared to all the other alternatives. That's a long-winded answer.
No, no, it's a good answer, Jason. It set the context, and I guess that when I was reading about this topic, I saw that in Australia, I mean, let me just step back a little bit. So I think you're not the first person to notice that these conductors are 100 years old, the basic aluminium steel strand. And the reason when they operate, they sag when you put more power in it, the line sags, which kind of determines, doesn't it, how far apart the transmission towers can be located, and also, I guess, the maximum power that you can put through the lines.
Yes, it's not only limiting how far you can span the towers, it is also defining the clearance, because power lines, they carry live current. They have to be kept at a safe distance away from structures, from roads, from buildings. And when you have a conductor that is saggy, because we have steel wires in, it puts a lot of constraint in terms of what you can do.
And so engineers have known this, I'm sure, for a long time and have experimented with a range of new materials. But of course, there are high costs if putting a new material in doesn't work. And engineers are very cautious, it seems to me, with telling their boss that this is a good idea if it doesn't work. And I think it's fair to say, when I was reading about this, that some of the technologies that have been developed had handling issues and essentially in practice weren't successful in the trials. Could you just maybe talk about this history of new technology, new transmission conductors, and what TS is doing differently about it?
Yeah. When you look at the evolution of conductors in the past 100 years, David, it is really a story of material science. About 50 years ago, when our steel industry was able to offer stronger steel and steel that you can maintain high strength at high temperature, we have a class of conductor called ACSS, which is aluminum conductor steel supported. And that conductor does allow you to go to high temperature because the aluminum is the annealed aluminum, so that you do not have the temperature limit of the aluminum. And when you operate these conductors at high temperature, you get that additional capacity. So you would be able to get ACSS to do reconductoring, for example. And when you use ACSS, the steel is still the steel core. And the sagginess, the heaviness of the steel core plays a role in terms of excessive sagging, especially when you operate these conductors at high temperature. So what it means is, when you do reconductoring, you have to retrofit the structures to make them taller so that you can maintain clearance. And if you do new transmission lines, you may actually have to bring these towers closer together to manage the excessive sag, that end up costing you far more on the structure because you have to work with more towers, which means more foundations as well.
And so we move from those to the various forms of advanced conductors. And, you know, to be clear, at least in the Australian context, which is my primary interest, it's the new transmission build that interests me. Because we have, going back to your initial statement, we have, I think by 2035, 5,000 kilometres of new transmission to be built and 10,000 kilometres by 2050 on the current plans. So that's 5,000 kilometres and representing something like $40 Australian billion of investment, maybe more, where we haven't really given much thought, at least I haven't, to the transmission. In Australia, we've had a very heavy debate because of environmental reasons, largely, about whether transmission should be above ground or below ground. But no one's said anything very much about changes in technology in above ground transmission, and that's where that's where my particular interest lies.
Okay, let me elaborate on that. When you look at underground versus overhead, the cost of underground is typically about 5 to 10 times the cost of overhead. When we think about energy transition, we also have to do it with affordability in addition to a sense of urgency. And I mentioned about the AZSS conductor. To address the excessive sagging issue, they were what we call advanced conductors emerging in the last 20 to 30 years. But these older generation composite conductor, as you said, they're fragile. They're very vulnerable to mishandling in the field. And utility industry, by design, they're very conservative. Safety, reliability are at the very top in terms of what the utility must have. And when you have that type of combination where the prior generation conductor, the advanced conductor, are very delicate, brittle, and not easy to work with, it creates a tremendous challenge to the utility and also to the utility engineers when they have to make a decision to fit in a new conductor. And this is where the TS technology comes in, that we fundamentally address the issue of workability of conductors in the field. We do not require perfection from linemen, and you cannot expect perfection from linemen either. What we have done is we have a pretensioning approach with our carbon composite core, and we use the layer of aluminum encapsulation, which is conductive, by the way, to preserve pretension in the carbon composite core. You might ask, why do you pretension the carbon composite core? Because if you look at these type of composites, they're superior in tension. If you do tensile strength on these conductor core, they're superior. But if you do compression on it from the ends, like for example, you have a bending situation, half of the material under the neutral axis, below the neutral axis, is under compression, and compressive strength is a property dominated by the matrix material, and it's only about 60 to 70% tensile property. So what it means is you will always have a vulnerability on the compression side when these older products are handled in, you know, bending situations, especially sharp edge bending. With TS conductor, we have that built-in pretension, which allows you to have greater robustness against bending because you have to overcome the pre-existing tension before it goes into the vulnerable compression state. And that's really what you need. Just like in the COVID days, a lot of people take a vaccine to boost your immune resistance. Here, we're boosting the conductor's robustness in the field. And right. By the way, David, we are also leveraging that aluminum encapsulation to shield the composite core from degradations like moisture, like oxidation, like UV. And If you have very high voltage, you may have corona, which is ozone. They yes. all have a detrimental effect on the polymer matrix in the composite. So we can eliminate all of that. And the aluminum encapsulation, it provides a cushioning protection of the carbon core when you use traditional crimping approach when you're doing conductor splicings and dead endings.
Good, Jason. All right. I obviously am a financial analyst, and I hear that, and it sounds very interesting, but I'm sure it's an electrical engineer or a power engineer or a transmission engineer that has to be convinced about all these bits and pieces. But let's just assume that that what you say is correct. And I think, judging by the backing that TS has so far received, that there's a lot of people that are convinced about this story. But and I'll come back to deployment. But before I get to that, I wanted to ask, what does it mean in terms of for new build? So obviously, something with carbon fiber in it is going to cost more than something with steel. But my understanding, and I might be wrong about this, is that the transmission towers cost as much as or more than the cable when we look at the costs of building out transmission. And my if I understand you correctly, not only can the transmission towers be built a bit lower, which I presume would mean a bit less concrete in the foundation and less visual impact, but they can be spaced further apart. And I'm thinking mostly of the transmission we're going to build is 500 kilovolts, some it's 350 or something, but a lot of it's 500. What would using your material mean in terms of the way you would design a transmission line, the number of towers per mile or kilometre, and the overall cost, and I guess the capacity for a 500 kilovolt line?
Yeah, that's a great question, because ultimately it is the project cost that matters. And whether you have a green technology or not, the economic aspect has to play out. If we are looking at new transmission lines, including Australia, by the way, it's very exciting to see Australia making massive investments in the coming decades. And if you use traditional conductor like the AZSRs, you might need, let's say, just put some numbers, 400 meters or 300 meters in terms of span distance. With TS conductor, our conductor does not sag the way that AZSR conductor might. So now you may be able to do it with 400 meters of span distance and even 450 or even longer span. That means you're going to be able to build a transmission line with significantly fewer towers or structures. When we talk about the cost associated with each tower, you have grounding cost for each tower site. You have the foundation, the labor associated with foundation work. You have the steel structure and the assembly labors as well. And you have the fittings that goes into the tower. All of that, if you add it up, in the US, if you do a 230 kV line or 345 kV line, each tower, the associated cost is almost $300,000. And when you look at the conductor cost, you know, three phases, in the US, our type of conductor is probably today about 2 to 3x in terms of comparing to AZSR conductor. That is only about, you know, 2-4% of the overall project budget.
And
you look at the structure.
Sorry,
cost.
Just to be clear on one point about that, that's for a single circuit or a double circuit. Would it be 8% if it was double circuit?
Yeah, you would have more. Yes. Let's say it's a single circuit.
No, I want to talk double circuit because that's what I care
okay.
about.
Okay. Then double circuit, it may be 5% in the cost, right? The structure associated cost, it's as much as 30% of the project capex. You can save far more on the structure-related cost to cover the modest premium a TS conductor might incur. And it's more than justifiable because the overall project capex is less. And you are getting more efficiency, and you are getting future-proof capacity as well compared to the traditional conductor approach.
Yes. So just let's in long distance transmission, and Australia has the longest, thinnest grid, I think, of almost in the world, really. It's the line losses that become a big feature, as opposed to the heat losses, I think. The line losses with your conductor don't change a great deal?
Yeah. The line loss is really a simple high school physics calculation.
Well, in that case, it'll be too hard. It'll be too hard for me. Yeah.
I square times R. Let's say you use the same current, but if the resistance is less, and in the TS case, it could be as much as 50% less because we pack more aluminum. We also use the most conductive aluminum, and our effective resistance is significantly less than the conventional conductor. That line loss saving is actually very significant, especially when you go to very long distance transmission lines. And these economics, right now, most of the regulatory framework in place for our utility industry do not have a mechanism or incentive for utility to consider more efficient conductor. But if we are able to have a mechanism to encourage utility to do the right thing, make the grid as efficient as possible, you're going to see a sea change in the behavior of utility and in the adoption of more efficient conductor. And I'll make this observation for you, David. One is, when you look at the electric generation and consumption, we have made major strides in efficiency improvements. On the consumption side, you look at the kitchen kitchenware, dishwasher, refrigerator.
Sure, Jason.
Star ratings.
You know, in Australia, you don't have to convince this audience about that sort of thing. I mean, we are full bottle. We are 40% pretty much renewable energy, wind and solar energy, in the whole of our 200 terawatt hour market. We get all that stuff, but
Wonderful.
We haven't built the new transmission yet, and we're going to be building, you know, 20 gigawatts of new wind and solar in the next 10 years, and the transmission to connect that just hasn't received, the technology in the transmission hasn't received, I don't think, the attention it could have. It may not happen, but it's certainly worth this discussion at the very least, in my opinion. Now, I also wanted to ask, you talked about ultraviolet resistance and stuff like that, but in Australia, we've actually had a number of our older transmission towers fall down recently, which didn't do anyone much good, because of increased straight line wind speeds in areas where they didn't used to have them. And there's an argument that climate change will make that wind speed, straight line wind speeds, worse. How does your conductor and spacing these towers a little bit further apart impact on wind resistance?
That's a great question. First off, it's not just the wind. There's also fire, and there's also in other places cold ice storms that we have to manage, because these events are becoming more common and more severe. In terms of the wind, our conductor has a very compact design. So what it means is, for the same amount of aluminum, the TS conductor is smaller, and the surface of the TS conductor is also smoother compared to the traditional conductor, because we use a trapezoidal aluminum strand that forms a very smooth surface, versus the traditional conductor, they have round aluminum strand, and they have those smaller interstitial gaps in there. The surface has that round strand roughness in there. And the wind load is really a function of conductor diameter and the roughness on the surface. So on both accounts, the TS technology would help to reduce or minimize the wind-related load to the conductor and then to the structure. In Europe, if you use trapezoidal configuration in the conductor, you could actually take a 40% reduction in wind load, and because there is actually less wind load to the conductor and to the structure. While we're on that topic about the resiliency against extreme weather. I want to make a point about wildfires. Let's say you have wildfires that are emerging that are passing through a transmission line. And you may have a residence time of a few minutes, the fire is burning right below the power line. If you use traditional conductor, you're going to be annealing the aluminum, and you are also going to be causing excessive sag because the steel expands, and they're going to bring the conductor closer to the fire right below. That will make the matter even worse. Even if the traditional circuit survives, the aluminum has changed into a softer aluminum that you will have permanent sagging that might create clearance issues. With TS conductor, the aluminum is already fully annealed, so you do not worry about losing properties in the annealed aluminum. And our composite core does not sag in the face of heat, so it's going to stay high above the fire right below the transmission line.
You're preaching to the converted when you talk about fire resistance in Australia. We have I know you have a lot of fires in California. We have more in Australia, so that, and in remote areas. So that's a great selling point. I just want to come back to deployment. I think it's fair to say that on the one hand, TS Comps is a very new company in the transmission business, but the deployment has been modest so far. What can you tell me about deployment?
Yeah, we do have multiple deployments, commercial scale, and this conductor is already volume manufactured in the U.S. In the U.S., we have customers like NextEra FPL, Tennessee Valley Authority, APS SRP, Mid-American in Mississippi River Crossing, MDU, Basin Electric, and there's also ComEd projects as well, which is part of Exelon. The technology was already deployed before U.S. In the State Grid Corporation of China. So it's already got a track record. It's a product that the line crew likes to work with because it is robust in the field. And we have been very blessed with utilities like National Grid, NextEra, and they are also our owners as well because they invested in TS. So our industry being conservative, you know, it does take time for a new technology to take off. However, this technology does check all the boxes, whether it's in performance, whether it's in economic value, or in safety, reliability, longevity that utilities are always expecting.
So, Jason, I think that pretty much covers as much as I would like to cover today. I hope that I will be able to come back and talk to you in another year or two, and there will be an even more exciting story about deployments to talk about. But I want to thank you for the opportunity to learn about a technology that I have had no previous history with. And it's interesting to me because it's a big area of investment, and we need to be talking about every part of it and how to make it better, I think particularly including transmission. So thanks very much, Jason.
Yeah, thank you, David, for the opportunity to share with you and your Australian audience about Advanced Conductor, about what we can do together to, you know, to shape the climate change topic. We can do it. We can do it affordably, and we can do it with a sense of urgency as well.
I love those. I love the sound. I love those words. Cheers, Jason.
And that was Jason Huang from TS Conductor. David, look, it's just fascinating to think that we've evolved so much in the rest of our energy transition, but barely advanced at all in the nature of cables. This seems to me to be like a whole new area, an opportunity opening up for us. I wonder if we can seize it.
Well, it's yes. I also wonder, Giles. I mean, as we talk a lot about underground cabling, we talk sometimes about DC versus AC transmission. Look, it's a fairly obscure topic, and it's hard for the likes of you and I to really understand a bake-off, as we used to call it, between one form of cable and another. It's not a cooking show. What else has been happening this week?
Look, I guess the one of the big announcements has been the Solar Sunshot thing that came sort of late last week. Anthony Albanese, Chris Bowen, the folk from Sun Drive and AG Earl and all sorts of other people, Arena, turned up to make this announcement, $1 billion to try and help create a solar manufacturing industry in Australia. Look, a lot of questions over this about why we would want to compete with the Chinese. In fact, are we trying to compete with the Chinese? It seems to be very much about creating some sort of sovereignty over our manufacturing, over our supply chain, and also seeking to sort of try and get advantages, on, at least on the silicon and the silicon processing part of it, which we would seem to have an advantage on it. And also answer the question is that considering we've helped develop most of these solar PV technologies, why the hell aren't we actually sort of making some of it ourselves?
Well, that's right, because as we know now, in Europe, solar panels are so cheap that they're using them for fences, right? And we've got a lot of fencing, so clearly we're going to need a lot of solar panels.
Yes, but I guess the question is about where do they come from? Look, in talking to, we had an interesting interview in the Solar Insiders podcast with Arena boss Darren Miller, and he's sort of pointing out that the opportunity is there. If Australia can actually sort of create something, then the Chinese might come in there as partners rather than sort of building everything in China. They might actually sort of build part of their supply chain here. And I guess that's the hope. I mean, if you think about the sort of the amount of solar that we'll need to build to meet those net zero targets, I mean, 80 gigawatts of rooftop solar just on households alone, let alone the sort of the large scale stuff. And if you start thinking about the green export scenario and the sort of the hundreds of gigawatts that will be needed. Look, it's an interesting play, criticised by some of the sort of the more conventional sort of economists around the place, but I'm not too sure why. But I mean, I would have thought that we spent so much money into the coal industry over time. We still subsidise fossil fuels to a huge extent, including subsidising all our sort of diesel imports, etc. I'm not too sure why not.
There's a question of where you can just get the best return for the buck. I mean, I think it's a bit of a misnomer to think that manufacturing all takes, all the bits and pieces of it all take place in any one geography. I think the modern concept of a firm myself is that you can have research and development in one country and the manufacturing somewhere else, and the distribution can be handled. There's a lot of outsourcing is what I'm trying to say. And Australia's traditional advantage has always been, and where our global expertise is recognised, is on the R&D side of things. And that's where we've got this new technology ideas, like substituting the silver in solar panels with copper, which is an interesting concept. So there's a lots of different angles to this story. In fact, you know, you bang out manufacturing, the actual assembly of the panels, it's not necessarily where all the labour's employed anyway, although I don't know the exact statistics, because so much of modern assembly's actually done with robots. A lot of the people are involved in all the other bits of the business other than working on the directly on the assembly line.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. David, look, another point that was raised this week was the final ruling on the MLFs is the marginal loss factor. I guess people would sort of commonly understand them as sort of grid congestion charges or the restrictions on output for wind and solar farms. This has been a bit of a running battle for the last 3 or 4 years, and I think that some of the main sort of lobby groups and some of the biggest developers are getting pretty fed up with this at the moment, mostly because of the conflicting signals, I guess, it sends about sort of, you know, where you should build wind and solar when we're trying to encourage people to build it, for instance, in renewable energy zones.
Part of the problem is that just isn't enough transmission and too many transmission bottlenecks. And this is another sort of fairly complex area of understanding that when you decongest one part of the system, just like the roads, you probably just shift the congestion to somewhere else. But I do think it's pretty obvious that when we're building renewable energy zones, one, we have to have enough transmission to them, and two, we can't have MLFs that disincentivize where we actually want the stuff to be built. So again, these MLFs are, in a sense, another hangover from the old way of doing things when new plant was only at very much on the fringes of what was going on, and everything was still coming basically from being done in the same old way. Now we have a regulatory system that is based on a British model that has monopolies for transmission and distribution that have to be regulated. Doesn't really have a concept of batteries or prosumers or any. Doesn't have a concept of rooftop solar in the current regulatory system at all. We have MLFs that are designed to sort of fit in with some arcane model of how things should be priced at the margin. And we have a transmission regulatory test that we have to tear down, and we don't. Well, all those sort of old ideas have to go away, and as well as that, we have to have this new idea of working with people, and you know, getting in early and understanding the psychological side of things, and getting everyone on board with the transmission, whilst at the same time trying to deal with myths about nuclear and stuff, which we won't talk about right now.
Declaring this a nuclear-free zone, at least for the
moment. Anyway, it's a tough job, even as a commentator, let alone the people who actually have to do it.
Okay, look, just finally...
no wonder they need two planes.
That, of course, is in reference to the two planes taken up to the Hunter Valley for the announcements for the Sunshot. And two RAAF planes were needed, apparently, to sort of take them all up there to the Newcastle... because they're making the announcement at the Liddell coal-fired generator. David, look, just one final thing. Problems in green hydrogen, Fortescue Metals still yet to reach a financial investment decision on Gibson Island. That's probably only really come to light because it is signed an MOU, or at least an intention to sign a long-term PPA with the Bulleye Creek Solar Farm, a key part of GenX Power's development program and what would be probably one of the biggest solar projects in the country. David, what's going on here? Look, I guess it's not surprising that this sort of Gibson Island is hard to reach financial close because it is a massive facility, 500 or 550 megawatts of electrolyzers, sort of difficult location, getting all that power in and then just sort of making that sort of transition. It sort of seems... this green hydrogen thing is kind of not happening quite as quickly as some would hope.
Yes, Giles. I mean, that's right. Look, Twiggy Forest, his heart is in the right place, but I do have to say that you'd make a lot of money out of betting on how much of his announcements actually turn into reality within the due time frame. I guess you could say... But, I mean, people make the same criticism of Elon Musk and look at all the actual achievements that he's actually put in place. I think hydrogen was a difficult bet for Twiggy. And I think if you have a project that depends on hydrogen being built, you know, you have to watch yourself very carefully and have a plan B. But one thing I'm absolutely certain of is that we need lots and lots more renewable energy getting built. And... I think that, you know, if it wasn't for the capacity investment scheme, I'd be very pessimistic because we have people sitting around with big projects that just not committing to them early enough. Developers do a lot of complaining, but not actually very much developing at the moment or building. And they've got a lot of reasons why they don't. But the reality is that at the very, very end of the day, they know their projects are going to be needed and they're needed now. A Raring Power Station will be staying open, it's almost certain, beyond when it was first announced to be closed, because there just isn't enough replacement capacity. I mean, Tilt's been sitting there with the Liverpool Ranges wind farm for years that it could have announced that it was going ahead a year and a half ago. Its Rye Park farm is half commissioned already, and it hasn't even started another one. I mean, the pace of these... Iberdrola, when was the last time... One of the biggest owners of renewable assets in the country. When was the last time they started a project? You know, no. Neoen's the only one that gets on with things, and they're slowing down a bit. You know, some of these big developers... I think need to have a hard look at themselves because their heart's probably in the right place, but they're not really backing the underlying reality. And I think they must have boards that are just far too cautious.
Interesting stuff, David. Look, David, we're going to have to wrap up here because we've actually got another interview appointment coming up for next week's podcast, which is going to be really, really interesting. So, thanks to Jason Huang from TS Conductor for speaking to us today. Thanks for doing that interview, David. Do listen out, as I mentioned before, for the Solar Insiders interview with Darren Miller. There's also a great interview on the Switched On podcast with Chris Taylor about Australia's heat pump problem and the fact that we might be importing all and giving money to and crediting all the wrong types of technology on heat pumps, which could be easily fixed if the regulators and the policymakers deem it so. But anyway, look, that's it for this week for the Energy Insiders podcast. Thanks very much to our sponsors, of course, Evergen and Pylon.
Yes, indeed.
And that's it for this week.
Energy Insiders was brought to you by Evergen, the market-leading renewable energy software business that optimises residential and commercial solar and battery systems. Evergen enables large numbers of systems to operate as a single fleet, so network operators can use them as a virtual power plant, generating significant value for consumers, network operators, and the energy system as a whole. Evergen software is powering the energy system of the future. Energy Insiders was also brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly cost, and no lock-in contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals.